professor, attorney, and sports business expert. Mark, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, Mark, the New York Times just ran an article the last couple days talking about a big case between amateur athletes and the NCAA. The good news is the athletes won, but they didn't really get what they wanted. Tell us about that case and what the outcome was.
That's right. The underlying case was Jenkins versus the National Collegiate Athletic Association. The case was grounded in antitrust law, and it really built upon the O'Bannon case from a few years earlier. What the players had argued was that the NCAA, which is composed of 1,200 member schools, that when the NCAA member schools reached an agreement with one another, in which every school agreed that to be a part of the NCAA, no school would pay its athletes, that was a restraint of trade that violates Section 1 of the Sherman Act. In other words, it's very clear, I'm sure, to all your users that Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola could not get together and set the price of their soda that the same way. They're part of the same market, and together they have most of the market. And I'm sure the listeners would also understand that Pepsi-Cola and Coca-Cola can't get together and set the wage of their workers at a lower rate than the free market. In essence, this is exactly what it was argued that the NCAA member schools and the respective conferences did, that they composed an entire market and they passed a rule that said college athletes pay, in essence, at zero. They won the case in that the district court came back and ruled that the NCAA member schools, much like most other businesses, have to follow antitrust law, and the restraints on college athlete pay indeed were wage-fixing violations or a group boycott that violated the law. However, the Ninth Circuit in O'Bannon came back and said that disallowing money tethered to education was not permissible, and the judge here relied upon that and limited what was mandated under the law to be provided to college athletes without restraint to financial payments in some way tethered to education. So it does not allow a free market for college athlete compensation, but it allows more competition to recruit athletes than we had seen in the past.
So the good news is players won. The bad news is from a material standpoint, it's still the status quo. They're still not getting paid. As I mentioned, the March Madness is about to start in a few days. There are going to be tens of millions of eyeballs watching that show. In fact, probably for the Final Four and for the final game of the tournament, it will probably be the most watched show on television. But the stars of those shows don't get a dime for doing that. I think that just strikes most Americans as wrong. But let's talk about the lives of these players. I mean, we see these kids. They do a great job. It's so aspirational, whether you're watching men's basketball or women's basketball. You know, I think the part of the NCAA tournament that people love is there's always this underdog story that nobody saw coming and everybody starts rooting for them. The reality is most of those kids are never going to play in the pros.
That is true, which is really unfortunate because most of these kids are being pulled out of the classroom to compete in these contests. If we look at March Madness, as much as we love March Madness, if we look at the playing games, it's Tuesday, Wednesday. We look at the tournament's first, third round, it's Thursday, Friday. We look at the championship game, which one would expect to be on Saturday or Sunday, and they put it on Monday night. So in essence, for the men's basketball team that makes it all the way to the finals, they are pulled out of class for, in essence, an entire month of the semester. And they're not paid for it. And you're right, most of them will not turn pro. So for most of them, the class time is incredibly important, and the NCAA tries to have it both ways. On one hand, they say, these are amateurs and these are students, we're not going to pay them. But on the other hand, the NCAA tournament makes so much money for the coaches and athletic directors that they're very happy to sell the rights to CBS and ESPN for the highest possible price. And the students or student athletes, if we want to call it that, their academic opportunities suffer at the same time they go unpaid.
Stepping back, though, there are numerous exceptions when players could be paid. You, kind of cover that. What is legal for us, for the teams?
Well, from my perspective, well, when we talk about legal, I presume you're not asking me what will the NCAA allow. You're asking me what will the law mandate.
Yes.
And at this point, the most recent court ruling says that the NCAA, which is composed of the member schools, could not concertedly stop, which means they cannot punish any member school for compensating the athletes in any way that relates to education. Now, if you want to take that in the fullest possible sense, as of this decision this past week, the NCAA could no longer limit colleges from recruiting athletes based on promises of study abroad that's fully covered books, fully covered computers and anything else that would be used for education, fully covered degrees that extend beyond their graduation, and presumably graduate and PhD degrees if they want to offer those as well. Now, keep in mind, nothing in the court opinion says that the schools can't do more. It is the NCAA, which is a collection of the member schools, that are threatening to sanction the schools that do more, that are preventing this.
So Mark, and I want to point out one other thing, and tell me if I'm incorrect on this. My understanding is if one of these kids is a star, they're playing a game, they break their ankle and they can't play anymore, not only do they lose that potential of becoming a pro, but they can also lose their scholarship, even though if that were to happen to most of us on our, quote, job, we'd be covered by workers' comp. And that just seems wrong. Is there any protection of the scholarship to get the education if these kids get hurt?
Well, at this point, at least in the highest conferences, the athletes could attempt to negotiate for a four-year scholarship. And that's more than they've had before. In most cases, it's still not out there. The reason why the athletes don't qualify for workers' comp, or in many cases are presumed not to qualify from workers' comp, goes back to a concerted decision that the NCAA made in 1953. Few people know that the word student-athlete, which is being used all the time by the NCAA, was the NCAA's own creation. And Walter Byers, who was the first commissioner, Walter Byers became the commissioner of the NCAA in 1953 during its substantial growth, has since admitted that he created that term specifically to make people not think of the college athletes as being workers for workman compensation issues and those matters. That's very unfortunate. And if we just look at what's gone on with the NCAA, it's amazing that and astounding that you have coaches that are making $5, $10 million a year, assistant coaches that are making several million dollars a year, trainers that are making up to $500,000 per year, that are fighting tooth and nail for every last penny and are also fighting to keep the athletes unpaid and to keep them away from workers' compensation, because what doesn't go to the athletes goes right into the coach's pocket.
Pac-12 Commissioner Larry Scott said in a statement, student athletes are first and foremost students who attend college to receive an education and to prepare themselves for success in life. There are basketball players who conclude their college careers before even finishing a year in college. What do you say about that?
Well, I have a few questions for Larry Scott. First, I would ask Mr. Scott why his conference's basketball team play games in the middle of the week, in which they have to fly the games and miss class. When Mr. Scott allows games to be scheduled on Tuesday and Wednesday nights, he's not playing students and academics first. Second, I would ask Mr. Scott why he allows the schools in his conference to play in the NCAA men's basketball tournament. If a team in his conference does very well and makes it to the finals, the athletes will miss upwards of 3 weeks per class. That's not putting education first. You could ask Mr. Scott why he allows the schools to have team practice upwards of 40 hours per week, more than a full-time job. That's not putting academics first. And you could ask Mr. Scott what would happen to the athletes in his conference if they said they couldn't practice on certain days because a class that was very important towards their degree was only offered during practice time. I think we know what Mr. Scott would say. Frankly, Mr. Scott, like so many others, are behaving disingenuously. You can't have it both ways. If you don't want to pay the players and you want to say it's about education, make it about education. And how can we claim it's about education as we go into the March Madness season and these so-called student athletes are being pulled out of the classroom by their own schools to help maximize revenues for the schools in these games. You don't get it both ways, Mr. Scott. You simply don't.
Boy, I would not want to be in the witness chair on the opposite side of a case you are arguing. Those are some great questions for Mr. Scott. Let me ask you some other questions. So we're talking about the NCAA. One of the things a lot of us like to do in the office is there's an office pull on the brackets and stuff like that. Do you have any comments on the legality? You know, is it a big deal if people are putting in $20, $100 on the office brackets? In a state like Utah, where gambling's illegal, is there a carve out? Is there a de minimis rule for something like that, or do we need to keep that hush hush when we're talking about it at Starbucks and maybe there's a police officer next to us?
Well, I can't tell you about the Utah law per se. You know, as a technical matter, if there's an entry fee and a prize, the NCAA tournament pools are games of chance. So as a technical matter, they would be deemed illegal. The question is anybody going to want to prosecute this? And, you know, there are two types of gaming exceptions that are out there. Some states have things directly on the book that say if they're in-home games, like poker games amongst five or six friends, and nobody's serving as a house, that it's not illegal. And that reasonably could be extrapolated to small groups of real friends that are playing an NCAA tournament pool. Other states that do not have that have exercised prosecutorial discretion. I don't think it's in the interest of any state to bust into the home of a few people and try to break up five people that bet on a sporting event. And I think of very few instances where things like that have occurred. With all that said, though, I think the people that really put themselves at substantial risk, and I wrote about this today for Forbes, are the ones who are doing it beyond just a few friends. And every year there are contests out there, and they tend to pop up around March Madness time and the NFL season, that are not four or five friends that are engaging in a fun activity, but lists of these online March Madness pools and end up with 100, 200, 300 people involved in them. At that point, it really begins to look like commercial gambling. And irrespective of whether we feel gambling should be legal or not, once you're doing this publicly on the internet, and once the amount of people involved becomes more than de minimis, then you're putting yourself at some risk of prosecution.
Okay, so let's wrap up with the NCAA on this. You've got expertise in so many different areas, and we want to talk about the different areas. You know, one of the new places that is really growing is this esports. People playing, they're not playing the game physically, they're playing the game in cyberspace, and this is becoming big business. Share with our audience how big of an industry this is already, and maybe some of the legal issues that are coming up in that field.
Well, esports is expected to cross the $1 billion plateau in the next few years. Just as a sign of how big esports has become, a story broke earlier today that Carlos Santana, the first baseman then with the Phillies, now with the Indians, broke an Xbox in his clubhouse because while the Major League Baseball players and the Phillies were supposed to be playing in a baseball game, they were focused on a Fortnite game in their clubhouse. You know, it's interesting what's going on with esports. I'm presently in China, and I can tell you within Asia, esports is huge, and they're selling out arenas in China and Korea, upwards of 20, 25,000 people to watch. I mean, the online viewership of a very recent esports competition around the world was just about higher than any other sporting event in recent years. I mean, in the college level, the NCAA is trying to take control of it because they see another revenue source. Television stations like ESPN are now figuring out how to broadcast this, and it's not going away. This is probably the fastest. If you consider esports to be a sport, it represents the fastest growing segment of the sporting industry.
Okay, so let's switch gears again. I understand from your bio that you've represented the Arena Football League Player Union and also a Major League Baseball team. Let's start with the Players Union first. What are typical issues that you're working on for players' unions?
Well, I can't speak about a current representation that I have with the Arena Football League Players Union, but I could talk more generally about union representation. The professional sports industry revenues are growing substantially in the United States, with some of the revenue streams that are growing most rapidly, including television and the gambling market. One of the challenges for the Players Association is to try to negotiate deals in which, as the overall pie grows, the athletes are better compensated. For a smaller league like the Arena Football League Players Union, the negotiation of salary amounts becomes even more important because we're not talking about type of money that will pay for four or five generations down the road. If you look at it, while the minimum Major League Baseball salary is approaching $500,000, most Arena Football League players have second jobs in the offseason.
Let me ask a question going back to the NCAA. Do you think players should be paid? Should there be salaries paid to these players?
I think it should be a violation of antitrust law for all of the schools to come together and refuse to allow any school to pay their athletes. I think schools, just like anything else in the free market, should be allowed to compete on free market principles. If Harvard University or my alma mater, the University of Pennsylvania, is able to recruit top athletes by offering such a strong level of education, well, then so be it. But I find it problematic that any one school or any collection of schools will prevent any other school from paying their athletes. If, for example, if the University of Michigan does not want to pay its athletes, that's where I went to law school, so be it. They don't have to. But for the University of Michigan to get together with a lot of other schools to stop Utah from paying its athletes, that's wrong. It should be up to any individual school, and they shouldn't be allowed to collude with others to stop schools from doing so.
Mark, you talked about just the business and how it's expanding, both on the gambling side as well as just the viewership side. There's also these new channels that are developing, things that maybe 20 years ago did not exist or maybe 30 years ago. One of those is fantasy sports. Talk to us about how big of an industry that is and maybe some of the legal issues there. And do the players get any compensation at all for these various teams where players are being drafted and recruited? Is there any way for them to make money off of this?
You know, it's an interesting question. I'd say probably about 80% of my representation at this point involves fantasy and online gaming marketplaces. If you include daily fantasy sports within the fantasy industry, and you look at all the auxiliary products, fantasy represents more than the $5 billion with a B dollars per year. As far as the players go, the mere use of players' names and statistics is not something that is treated as a property right, or at least most cases have found it not to be a property right. There was a case about 10 years ago, CBC versus Major League Baseball Advanced Media, and another one, Daniels versus FanDuel, that came down the past year, have found the mere use of players' names and statistics was allowable under the First Amendment. So in that way, players have tended not to directly profit from fantasy, but they profit in some other ways. You've had players that have directly endorsed fantasy games in exchange for a fee, so that's one way in which they have. A second way is to the extent that fantasy increases interest in the sport overall, and the increased interest in the sport overall has led to more viewership and more revenues. Then in collective bargaining negotiations, and especially ones where players get a fixed share of the overall pie, then the pool of money that would go to the players would go up. So indirectly they do, but directly not necessarily in the way you would expect.
Okay, great. Let me ask you another question. You're a sports attorney. You've been doing this for a long time. You've got a great pedigree. You graduated magna cum laude from Wharton. You graduated cum laude from Michigan Law School. A lot of credentials there. There are a ton of people in the world, or at least in the United States, that love sports, would love to figure out a way to make a living and have their career be in the sports-related industry. Jerry Maguire made what you do and some of your colleagues do very sexy and very appealing. If somebody's interested in getting into the sports industry, maybe as an attorney, maybe as a business manager. What advice do you have for them?
The two first pieces of advice I would give would be to go to the best academic schools that you can go to, because it is in a competitive marketplace. And as soon as you start interning, start interning. The sports world is a very small and very closed universe. It's very difficult to break the walls onto the inside. But once you're on the inside, you're part of a small group. So first, take your education very seriously and go to the best schools that you can and do as well as you can. But second, don't be above interning. Between my first and second year of law school, I worked for the major indoor soccer league at $500 a month and slept on somebody's futon. The following year, I went to Skadden Arps as a summer associate and made quite a bit more than that. So it really is a matter of building relationships, paying your dues, but also saying you love sports is not going to be enough. Learn the underlying legal or business issues and stand out that way.
Great. And a related question. Earlier, we were talking about amateur athletes. Curious your advice. Let's say you're going over a friend's house. Your friend's son or daughter is a great athlete. They've been offered a full scholarship to a big name school. What advice do you have for them to make that experience best prepare them for their future?
Well, my first question would be what sport? And my second question would be, are they good enough to go pro at this point? I mean, my recommendations really stem from there.
Let's say they're not good enough to go pro.
Stay away from them.
Most kids aren't good enough to go pro.
Sorry?
I was just going to say, I was going to clarify for you, in my example, most kids aren't good enough to go pro. Let's say they're really good, they're going to play, but they're probably not going to go pro. What advice would you have for them?
I would encourage them to use the athletic opportunity to get into the best school that they could get into. If they want to play for a short period of time, do so. And at the point in time in which it becomes clear that they are not able to go pro, they need to balance the pros and cons of playing sports versus not. If they're getting very good leadership opportunities and building credentials and experience and are doing well in school and they're loving it, by all means, continue to do it. If I found out, however, that I had a friend whose kid was looking to go to a school like University of Maryland under DJ Durkin or Michigan State in this current era, I would stay far, far, far away. I continue to be horrified by the board of directors at the University of Maryland for sending DJ Durkin back to coach a team after a football player died. And I think you have to look very closely at the programs and the people who are running it and try to make sure that you're choosing an environment, if you're going to play a sport, that's comparatively more ethical.
And Mark, we have 1 minute left, and I apologize for having stepped on your reply earlier. Let's take the opposite side of that. Let's say the kid's good enough that they might have a shot at going pro. What advice would you have for the kid and for the family?
I would encourage them to try to go to a school that will both give them the opportunity to showcase themselves and gain skills to go professional, but at the same time, at least carry a cachet in terms of the weight of the school name, that even if they are being pulled out of class, there still would be some cachet to it. If you're looking at an ACC program, I'd say go to Duke. If you're looking out west, I'd say go to Stanford. But make sure you choose a school that not only has the athletics, but just to fall back. If you're going to spend the time and do academics, make sure to go to a place that has academic rigor, and make sure to go to a place where there's some brand name associated with the school. Because if you don't go pro, that's really what the work world will look at.
Let me ask one more question about, you want somebody to represent you. How do you find that? I mean, there are scouts there are scouting programs. Who do you look for? What kind of a person, what kind of an organization do you look for to represent you if you're good enough to be represented in professional sports?
Well, one of the unfortunate problems right now, and the rules are slowly beginning to change, but the NCAA currently has rules that prevent athletes from signing with agents while they're still eligible for college sports, which really pretty much means that they could use lawyers, and many of these people lack means. One of the unfortunate things, there are more people that call themselves NFL-certified agents than there are NFL players right now. And most of the people that are running around as Jerry Maguire helpfuls do not have the background. I'd look very carefully at the track record of who the athletes have represented in the past. what their reputations have been. And first and foremost, will these people have shown themselves to be ethical and care about the individuals they represent? If you're going to get advice, it's important to get advice from people that the priority is to you, not to them. It's not to the colleges, but it really is to the athlete. And that's the foremost importance to me.
Well, Mark, we thank you for joining us. We understand you're in China, so we thank you for making the effort. Our guest this morning has been Mark Edelman. He's a law professor, attorney, and sports business expert. Mark, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Have a good evening.
And stay tuned to Mountain Money. We'll be right back to wrap up in a moment.